everybody, and welcome to another episode of Mormon Expression. This is Heather, and today I have gathered a few friends to talk about the General Relief Society meeting in conjunction with General Conference. Today in our group, we've got Robin and Amy and Elisa and Cindy. Robin, can you remind us what episodes you've been on? Because you haven't been on in a little while, have you?
I haven't been on for a while. The sexuality episode and some of the book clubs.
Okay, and how about you, Amy?
I have been on the top 10 Mormon bad guys list. Actually, Robin, you were there as well.
That's true.
And I've been on the Temple Recommend podcast, and I was an unwritten guest on the D&C 8 and 9 podcast, and this one. So I guess this would be number 4.
Oh, you're almost ready to have your bio put on the website.
OMG!
And how about you, Elisa?
My first one was Mormon Enigma. I've also been on the Battlestar Galactica. And my most recent one was, I was the fly in the blender analogy on the listener essay submissions.
Excellent job on that, by the way. I thought that was a great, great submission.
Oh, I appreciate it. Took a lot of work.
And I laughed out loud at work in a silent room at the mother bleepin' profanity bit.
Yeah, that was my genius. Husband's idea.
It was genius. All right. Well, I'd also like to mention that my husband is here presiding over this podcast because, you know, we need to have a priesthood member in attendance to make it official, right?
Absolutely.
Hey, yes. I'm a priesthood holder.
I don't think
By the way, I've never done a podcast before, so.
That's right. Cindy, this is your first episode, right?
I'm a podcast virgin, but I have been on the radio for, 15 years? I've had a talk radio show, so.
Oh, really? And what talk show is that?
I was on the Weasel of the Week show.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we were voted the most favorite talk show for 3 years in a row in the City Weekly, way back in the day, so.
Oh, okay.
Cool. I've done radio before, but it's been quite a while, so.
Well, you're still a pro, it sounds like.
Yeah, I'm trying.
Well, why don't we go ahead and get started? The first talk given at the General Relief Society meeting, and before we actually get into that, I want to point that out. I listened to these online, and the second time, I noticed at the beginning of Uchtdorf's talk that he said he always looked forward to the annual General Relief Society meeting. And it just kind of stuck out to me as like, this isn't a session of conference, ladies. This is something separate. You don't get a session of conference. Did anybody else notice that?
I did, but I didn't make that connection. I did feel a little bit diminished by it, even though I'm not even a member of the Relief Society. But I do remember him saying meeting, and I thought, oh, bummer, this is just a meeting.
Yeah, this isn't General Conference. But
my experience, in fact, whenever I've been on, usually around about this time of the year or April, is someone on the boards will almost always post some kind of picture with a big, you know, open with paint red circle on the open chairs, the empty chairs, and make some kind of notation of who was missing. So when everyone started piling in, when, you know, Thomas S. Monson and Uchtdorf and all the other guys, I was thinking, oh my gosh, what is going to happen? Because I was not expecting to see the entire first presidency. And if you, I wrote down in my notes that, and we'll get to more of this when we start talking about Sister Julie Beck's talk, was that she called this a historic event. And I didn't know if that had to do with singularly the new Relief Society book that was out or the total package, if it was the fact that the first president was there at the unveiling of this great book to lend it legitimacy and to really impress upon the sisters as to how important this is. I don't know. Anyone else want to comment on that?
Yeah, I wondered if that was going to happen too, but frankly, the whole thing ended up being rather underwhelming. You know,
nothing
special really occurred other than the unveiling of the Daughters in My Kingdom book.
I agree. I was pretty bummed out too. I was expecting like the second coming or something.
Yeah, I agree. I was thinking, oh, the whole First Presidency, maybe something's going to happen.
Yeah. Baby Jesus is coming.
Reinstituting polygamy.
Yes.
Okay, so the first talk was what I hope my granddaughters will understand about the Relief Society.
Oh, and by the way, like I noticed, so that's what she said the title of her talk was, but then if you go to LDS.org, they've modified it. So now that it's what my granddaughters and grandsons will understand about us, even though she never said that.
No, she didn't say that. Not at all.
Don't have anything that's just ours?
No.
No, you don't have anything. What I also noticed, and I made note, was that the opening prayer was, and I thought it was odd because I'd never heard this before, but she, in asking for blessings of the First Presidency, she specifically said, bless their children and grandchildren, President Monson's children and grandchildren. And I thought, that's kind of odd to want to bless his, to single him out and want to bless his grandchildren. And then, of course, as all these talks continued to go on, the mentioning of grandchildren and my grandchildren, and I hope the grandchildren and their grandchildren. It was like, what is going on? What kind of new catchphrase, what kind of new buzzword is this grandchildren?
Do you think that they might be a little bit worried about the new generation kind of opening their mind to see what might be at opposition to what they believe? I mean, I
really interesting point. I think it's
I think that's a good point.
Well, there's also research out there that has shown that young people are falling away from all religion, and the church isn't, you know, an exception to that.
Well, I think, you know, the testimony glove that they just unveiled not too long ago for young children to teach them how to have a testimony. I think
I don't know about that. Tell me.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of like the Mormon version of the Michael Jackson glove, but it's so much better.
Dallin H. Oaks' wife created it with some help, and it basically has five parts of a testimony, and you can use this glove, and it has pictures on each of the fingers, and you teach your children about these five parts of the testimony, and that's how they learn to have a testimony, that kind of thing.
And then, also like the French, you can take it off and slap people with it.
Forget what the five things were. I remember a picture of President Monson. So one of them is a prophet. One of them is Joseph Smith. I can't remember the others.
Jesus Christ, your family, probably.
Yeah. I think Book of Mormon is just the thing that's missing. I guess that's wrapped up with Joseph Smith. Probably.
Yeah, I think so.
So she went on to talk about, or Julie Beck, I mean, went on to talk about the Relief Society. And the first thing that stuck out to me was that she said it was an ancient organization, which I don't know how much proof there is for that. Did you guys?
You know what? I honestly sat and listened to that, and my husband was listening to it at the same time. And he said, where is there evidence that the Relief Society was back in the day of Martha and Mary? I mean, I don't know if she specifically said that that's when the Relief Society started, but it was kind of the connotation. And
yeah, well, I think in the Daughters in My Kingdom book, the first chapter is devoted to explaining how Relief Society is an ancient organization that was that Christ created while he was on the earth. And the only I know I find it very laughable, but the only evidence that they give to support that claim is a quote by Eliza R. Snow saying that Joseph Smith told her that the Relief Society was an ancient organization. You know, kind of referencing the sixth article of faith idea that the same organization that existed in the primitive church exists today. And I think the main purpose of that, for Julie Beck to kind of want to establish that the Relief Society is an ancient organization is to kind of show, see, like, Christ wants women to have their own separate organization, separate from the priesthood. So to kind of reinforce the idea that the contemporary church's auxiliary structure is divine, that it's what Christ instituted when he was alive on the earth, and therefore it can't be changed or modified in any way. It has to remain this way.
Oh, that's a nice story.
She did mention also that it was the apostasy that caused women to fall away from leadership, as though that was our punishment, that there was some kind of, I don't know, did anyone else remember her saying that? That kind of, I wrote that down. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. Men got the priesthood back, but we didn't get really anything back.
Oh, you naughty, naughty girls.
Well, you know.
I think that the apostasy would have to apply to the Relief Society if they're then going to claim that Joseph Smith reinstituted it so that there would be continuity between the primitive church and the modern church. And I agree with Elisa. I think it's a tactic to say that there is no inequity in the church, that men have priesthood and women have Relief Society, and those are the two equal parts.
Oh, yeah, separate but equal.
Yeah, I really liked what you said about that in your
blog entry.
Blog. I don't think anything more perfect has been applied to the status of women and the church than that. I was kind of like, wow, it's so glaringly obvious. I can't believe it hasn't occurred to me before to even think of it in that way.
Yeah, just to recap what Amy's talking about is that I really feel that the church's structure today could be called separate but equal. You know, like we have Relief Society, we have the priesthood. They're separate, but they're supposedly equal. And the reason why I think that is a really pernicious term, I mean, that's essentially how Jim Crow laws worked in the South prior to the civil rights movement in the 60s was, its purpose was to create two classes of citizens. And in this case, it's, men and women, with the purpose of denying the second class of citizens, the women, any real kind of power or voice within the governing body. So, yeah, that's kind of my opinion about that.
Brilliant.
So the other thing that stuck out to me was that when she was talking about the way that the Relief Society functioned in Joseph Smith's days, she left out some pretty key things. The book does as well, the Daughters in My Kingdom book. I don't believe there's any talk of women anointing and giving blessings. I don't think there's any talk of Joseph Smith intending women to have the priesthood. And she also made it very clear that the Relief Society is under the priesthood, not in the priesthood. Did you guys feel like she was saying that?
Absolutely.
Well, definitely.
She repeatedly stated that the Relief Society was to prepare women for the blessings of the priesthood in the temple, which I know that Robin and Elisa and I just kind of kept looking at each other like, what is she talking about? Like, that to me, I can't imagine the link. I can't pretend to make it. I don't know how they're making it. That how is being a part of the Relief Society going to prepare women for priesthood blessings in the temple? Anyone can help me with that one?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that part of it was that, so one of the initial reasons why Sarah Kimball and the others kind of proposed the idea of the Relief Society to Joseph Smith was so that they could do some work to help aid in helping the temple, you know, like crushing up their fine china, that story you hear all the time, mm-hmm. or whatever it was. They were going to help, like, sew for it or do things like that. But that was only one of its many purposes. You know, it was essentially a service organization devoted to identifying the needs of the poorer saints in the community and how they could help them, and also to help with sicknesses and things like that. And as you mentioned, Heather, a lot of what they did was the women would actually lay their hands on other women's heads and give them blessings to heal them and things like that. And none of that is mentioned in Beck's representation of the early Relief Society, and it's not mentioned in the book either.
Well, my grandmother, I mean, I'm probably a lot older than you guys, but my grandmother tells a story about when my mother was born, And the women at that time, when she was in labor, she was out in the middle of whoever knows where, and she went into labor, and she claims that there were women that came from the Relief Society, and they blessed her with oil and delivered her baby. And it was a testimony throughout my whole life that she claimed brought my mom into this world and saved her life. She gave birth to my mom, and everything was cleaned up and taken care of by the time my grandfather came back. But it was her testimony of these women that had the priesthood blessings with the oil, and they delivered my mom. It was very real in my mind. So the fact that they don't talk about that at all, it makes me wonder what are they, I don't know, are they backtracking? Are they worried about what has been said in the past? I mean, I come from old school, but anyway, that's just kind of a thought.
Yeah. I mean, for me, the first time I kind of learned about women, and the practice of faith healing and things like that, it was just like, it was amazing to me. I was like, oh my goodness, I can't believe that this was going on. I thought it was so cool and so interesting, and it just completely shifted the way I thought of the Relief Society when I learned about that kind of thing. And so to have that kind of written out and not acknowledged just seems like a glaring omission to me, and a real flattening of the kind of power that women really used to have. So when she first started talking about studying the history of the Relief Society about a year ago, I was starting to get excited. I was like, well, maybe she wants us to discover this really cool history that we have. I don't think that's the case. So
I don't think so too. It's a little scary. I mean, it gives women more power than I think they really want women to have.
I'm curious to know what they honestly think would happen. What kind of negative effects could happen if women were able to bless their family members and bless the women that they visit, teach, how that could possibly minimize what men do. I don't understand it. I really, truly don't. I don't understand what it is they are so worried will happen if there's a true partnership. It saddens me when I hear a story of Cindy, how you say your mother was born into those circumstances. I think that is an empowering, beautiful, faith promoting, like that's a rock solid deal. I want that deal.
It was honestly, it's one thing that set me up. During my childhood and growing up, I believe that the women in the church had a real presence. And then as I got older, and I'm close to 50 now, as I got older, I realized that it was being minimized. Everything was being minimized. I would bring the story up, and it was, you know, they kind of downplay it, and oh, well, that's what grandma said. And well, we're not quite sure that's what happened. I'm thinking that was one thing that was so prominent in my mind and my memory and the stories that were told to me as a child. And I believed that those beautiful women had that power. And I still to this day believe they do. But I'm wondering why in the world it seems to me it's going backwards in the church now. You know, being a woman myself, I know my beautiful power and what I can achieve, but it seems to me like it's being diminished one step at a line upon line, precept upon precept, backwards.
Yes.
So that's just my.
But seriously, what is taken away from men if women want to bless each other during childbirth? What really is taken away from men? I'm putting that out there in the universe. I don't understand it. I understand the plain, simple idea of a patriarchy and just the simple extension of power, but it doesn't fit to me. It's a puzzle piece that just doesn't make sense. Like, if it were a closing argument, I would not be buying it.
Well, I listen to an awful lot of Christian talk radio, and an awful lot of it is quite conservative talk radio. Conservative Christian talk radio. And one day I remember a survey that they talked about where men felt like church was too feminine And that's why they were hesitant or less likely to participate, because it was too girly or too feminine. That was the term. And then on the other hand, I've also heard the justification for men having the priesthood and women not having it is that women are more naturally spiritual, and that men need like an extra push to keep them active. And
I hate that too, because it doesn't, where's the validation then of that power? There is none. They can't say we have it and then not allow us to use it.
Right. But I'm wondering, I mean, I don't have an answer for that question as to what would men lose, but I wonder if that might be part of the thinking that
I do think you might be right. Like, I remember reading in Mother Jones not too long ago how the strategy of a lot of Christian megachurches these days is to definitely target the male in the family, because they know that if they can get the male to come to church, then they've got the whole family. I don't know if that's why the LDS Church is doing it themselves, but for these Christian megachurches, it's a smart business move to really make it so that the male has some sort of real reason to invest in that religion. And I don't know, maybe this plays into that.
You know what's really terrifying about that is that if Gary Busey can be a board of directors on the Promise Keepers, and he's somehow more holy than even Julie Beck, that is makes me throw up a little bit in my mouth.
So I think we should probably move on to another talk, but I wanted to throw out one more thing. Towards the end of her talk, she's talking about Relief Society, and she says that women today are suffering with every possible struggle in life. And at one of the first things she listed as a possible struggle for women is suffering from unrealized dreams. And I thought, oh, so she's acknowledging that women are sacrificing, you know, their own identities and their own lives to fill this role within the church. And maybe that's not what she meant by it. Maybe that's just my apostate reading on it. Maybe she meant like unrealized dreams in how many children somebody wanted or how much money her husband would make or something like that. But
I did write down that she had stated that women had loneliness and disappointment, that there were women who were having a lot of loneliness and disappointment through not having a family. So I don't know if it's too far off from the old status quo, but at least they're acknowledging that some people are not that happy.
Yeah, but I think they kind of minimize some of this unhappiness.
Well, it's all minimized.
Throughout, definitely. I'm sure we'll talk about it a little more later. But at the same time, I just wanted to mention where she used the words spiritual illness. And I'm like, oh, whatever would she mean by spiritual illness? So, which I just think is kind of an awful way of, I'm just guessing, someone who is having doubts. The fact that they're having doubts is called a spiritual illness.
Well, of course, we're all suffering from spiritual illness in the eyes of the church.
It's like the
too bad we can't lay our hands on each other and heal.
I was thinking, thinking about laying on of hands, but in a very different way. But I will put those homicidal thoughts out of my head.
So the next talk was by Sylvia Allred, who was the first counselor in the General Relief Society presidency, and her talk was called Charity Never Faileth. What'd you guys think of her talk?
I thought that the topic was really wonderful. Just kind of sum up, I've kind of been letting it simmer in my head since it's been almost a week now. She talked about being long-suffering and relieve the poor, and charity is the pure love of Christ. Charity purifies. Charity is a divine gift. I'm thinking, oh, good stuff. Who can argue with this? And then over the last couple of days, I've kind of been thinking about it and not trying to find any criticism, but trying to look at it from, okay, how does this apply to my life as someone who's no longer a member? And two of the things that really kind of stuck in me like a thorn, I suppose, would be that there was no mention of charity to anyone other than members of the church, and that charity is not a natural state of being, because she lists out the ways to be a charitable person. And one of those ways is you have to pray to become charitable, read the scriptures. And once again, you know, only one way to be charitable is be an LDS woman. Only one way to serve and be charitable is to serve LDS women. And I thought there was a huge opportunity that was missed to really expand the view of women in general of just being, putting themselves out there and being this part of this great social program, which is the Relief Society. But she only spoke about serving members of the church. And that really bummed me out. It really bummed me out that they've just chosen once again to build a little wall around themselves.
Let me piggyback on what you just said, which is that I think off the top of my head, if somebody were to ask me how I would develop charity, I'd be like, oh, maybe go volunteer at a soup kitchen, or I'd go, you know, volunteer to help earthquake victims or something like that, you know, some kind of service or something like that. So it was really odd how the main way that she talked about developing charity in this talk was through visiting teaching. And I thought that was interesting because what she's saying is that the way to develop charity is through service to the institutional church. Mm-hmm. And it's only through the church's programs that we learn to develop charity, not through some other means of service that people outside of the church would recognize as actual service or things that would help, you know, help you draw a kinship towards people other than yourselves.
You know, when my Elisa and Robin knew that I was texting my mother throughout the conference, and I was really excited to be there as an apostate member, I suppose you could call me quite easily, actually. I was really excited to be there. I'll admit, Robin called me out. I was having a bit of a panic attack at the beginning of this. I was sweating profusely. There was way too much of all of it, but I wanted to get through it, and I wanted to really come to it and with an open mind and really see if I could walk away with something really valuable and not just automatically go, eh, it came from the LDS church. It's not valuable to me. And afterwards, I had mentioned to my mom that I had taken lots of notes and that I would send her an email letting her know my thoughts on it. And I've composed most of the email, and I don't really know if I can send it because I realize that this message in so many ways doesn't apply to anyone else other than members of the church. And I specifically talking about being charitable, I mentioned to her that the three steps were, one, you must have a desire to be charitable, which totally reminded me of the 12 steps of AA. You have to be, you know, admit you're powerless. that you had to pray to get it. Well, there's only one method to pray that's legitimate in the LDS church. And that you needed to read scriptures, which we all know that the only legitimate scriptures in the LDS church is the Joseph Smith translation of the Bible and the Book of Mormon, et cetera, et cetera. And so I was mentioning this, and then it was kind of like dot, dot, dot. Well, I guess I'm not a charitable person. I guess that means I'm not a charitable person. And just, you know, once again, putting that wall up, putting it's the us and the them. And I don't think they even, here's the topic, charity, which is helping others, and they still manage to turn it into an us and a them. It baffles my mind. How do you turn charity into a selfish act? They did.
Well, and also a checklist. They turn it into a checklist of things to do rather than something that organically develops through interacting with other people,
love.
You know?
Love wasn't on that list. Love wasn't anywhere near that list.
Well, yeah, and then that very checklist is something that's belittled later on in the meeting. So
right.
It's like you can't win.
No, yeah. There's a lot of that back and forth happening. One speaker's contradicting what the other speaker is saying is important. And then Uchtdorf did a whole roundabout, big old, what do you know, when, so, yeah, anyway.
Yeah, we'll get to
Personally, I think some of that, the way you find charity is through the church is to be expected. I think it fits right in with, how do you have morals if you're not religious and you don't believe in God? You know what I mean? Like atheists are incapable of morality. I think, you know, the church thinks they've got the market cornered on truth, and they have this whole narrative of who we are as people and where we came from and where our good desires come from and where our bad desires come from. And so it's all within that framework. So to me, it makes sense that they would couch it in that and not make it open to outside, I don't know, outside cause.
I agree. I'm currently reading Letter to a Christian Nation, the Sam Harris book. I'm kind of in the bathtub reading it. And one of the things that kind of stood out, and in kind of comparison to the message of charity, is in the very beginning of the book, he talks about the goal of Christianity on its face is to alleviate the suffering of others through this divine message of grace. And of course, we all know that there's not a lot of divine messages of grace going on in the LDS Church. But I know that once again, I was just kind of like the juxtaposition of the LDS Church. And I had a lot of evangelical friends in high school. And I've kept in touch with them from time to time. And I have family that's born again. And so I get, you know, two totally different messages of what Christianity is. And while I don't identify myself as a Christian, I know that the messages of Christianity, and like you said, Heather, you know, Mormons can have the corner on truth. It's just such a different message.
Definitely. One other thing that I wanted to point out about that talk, she mentioned how she has a painting of Christ picking up the black lamb on her wall in her office to remind her about charity. And I really don't, I understand why the parable of the black lamb is used, the black sheep or whatever, to talk about that one person who's fallen away and doesn't think they belong or whatever, and bringing them back to the fold. But the problem with that analogy, and maybe this doesn't apply to all religion, but I think it definitely applies to Mormonism, is that once, you know, the church brings that black lamb back into the fold, they're intent on bleaching it white. You can't stay a black lamb and stay within the fold. You have to change into a white sheep. So that parable never works for me.
Of a holy person, Heather, come on.
Right, exactly.
That's a good point, Heather.
Naturally.
Yes.
That's funny that you say that, because on my notes that I wrote, Jesus heart black sheep, when she said that with an exclamation point.
Yeah, I remember you pointing that out to me.
So the next talk was given by Barbara Thompson, and she's the second counselor in the Relief Society General Presidency. And her talk was called Cleaving to Covenants. And basically, the whole point of her talk was that if we keep covenants and we keep the commandments, that we will find joy and protection, and they bring good things into our lives.
I'll tell you, the first, when she starts speaking about her great-great-grandmother and reading her patriarchal blessing, mm-hmm. one of the things, and it just kind of gave me a little bit of a chill, because I don't hear things like this very often, but she's, you know, reading or reciting what she has read in her mother, her grandmother, her great-grandmother's patriarchal blessing, and she's talking about, you know, thou was chosen before the foundation of the earth, and then goes on and on and on to say, oh, but the destroyer has sought to destroy thee, and retire to thy secret closet and pray. And I just remember kind of getting like a little bit of a shudder, like it's that adversary keeping you from your covenants once again, and the destroying angel I don't know, that one kind of, it just kind of, that whole, the tone of that talk kind of creeped
kind
me
of fear
out
based sort of rhetoric.
Just the language of it, that the destroyer has sought to destroy thee. I mean, that's just so Old Testament.
Well, I think Mormonism is trying to bring the Old Testament back into Christianity, so that would make sense, kind of.
Well, there you go. There you go. She did say we are a covenant people. I mean, that's Israelites, right? I mean, that's a direct reference.
Right, tying the primitive church into the current church.
Right. Well, another thing that I thought was interesting, how I guess the reason why this ties into Relief Society is that she was talking about how Relief Society helps us to prepare it and to make and keep covenants in the temple, you know, the young women line. The question I had is, why do women need an organization devoted to preparing them to keep covenants? Do men have a similar organization? Like, does the priesthood do that for them? I just thought it was kind of odd, because I've never really thought of the Relief Society as being something that prepares me to make covenants or keep them. You know, I never really made the connection between the Relief Society and the temple, really, you know, but anyway.
Well, the Relief Society used to be a temperance society as well. You know, part of the mission statement that was created by Eliza R. Snow and Emma Smith involved calling people out on their immorality in the public meeting and, you know, talking about it or fixing it, or I don't know what they were going to do with, at that point. But, and they, in those early meetings, they spent a lot of time calling people on the carpet, you know, and outing.
Fun.
Yeah. Sit back and knit and watch all the fireworks. But
that's good to me.
So maybe that's where they're pulling it from. They're trying to incorporate that little bit of church history into saying that, well, it's to keep you on the straight and narrow to go get your covenants taken out in the temple. I mean, your endowments. Well, should we get to the talk that is the sole reason that the meeting was convened?
No doubt.
The next...
Oh, do you care if I kind of set it up a little?
Sure, go for it.
I think it's really interesting. So we're talking about the final talk, which is Dieter F. Uddorf's talk. I really was thinking how it's interesting how the priesthood leader is positioned in a place of key prominence in the meeting. First of all, he speaks last, which means that he's in the position of the keynote speaker. We all sing a hymn, and for those of us who are in the conference center, we all stand up and stretch right before he speaks, so we'll be awoken and ready to listen to him. And all of this kind of has the effect of... Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so we don't throw a clot in the middle of his talk.
so all of this has the effect of treating the Relief Society presidency as kind of like the opening band that you have to sit through in order to get to the band that you really came to listen to, the priesthood leader. Mm-hmm. And so it's no wonder that the audience responds so enthusiastically to what Uchtdorf has to say.
Which is why my mother's text messages increased at the time that Uchtdorf took the center stage. She was all a Twitter.
Well, and he's also like the rock star of the general presidency, right?
Well, he's supposed to be the hot one, apparently.
Right. He's hot.
He's really got that Hans Lander appeal, if you've seen that movie.
I'm the age of your dad.
Because what we're comparing him to is all like nearly dead. So he's like fresh meat.
Okay. So the talk was given by Elder Uchtdorf, and it was called Forget Me Not. And he basically opens by talking about being in a garden with all these beautiful roses and things, and how he didn't overlook the forget me not. And then he tied that into like five things that you shouldn't forget. What did you guys think?
Well, can I start initially? Because before he even fully developed his metaphor there, I noticed the picture of his wife and daughter in front of flowers. And I was like, oh no. I thought that was just horrible. I'm like, now he's going to start comparing women to a garden.
And yeah, don't you love how women have to be flowers? How that's the metaphor that he's going to organize his talk around is flowers. And not only a flower, but a forget-me-not. Yeah.
Well, yes. The first thing I wrote before he even got to any of his five steps in which he compares, you know, he uses the five petals, was, and this is exactly what I wrote, tells a short story about forget-me-not, two outbreaks of gentle, pandering laughter erupt. And this was the first time that the whole tone of the meeting shifted, and it was like, we women were all these little lap dogs, and we were just panting and waiting for a little bone, and we were just drooling and just fluttering and just couldn't contain ourselves. And then he said something kind of funny, and I laughed, and it was so bizarre.
Well, in the beginning, it wasn't even funny because he only said what kind of flower. Because he only said something like he mentioned the kind of flower, the forget-me-not, and everyone laughs. And I'm like, what's so funny about a forget-me-not?
Yeah, I kind of wondered what people were laughing about. I wondered if like he was making a gesture that I couldn't see or...
No, he wasn't.
It was a laughter of uneasiness.
I think so.
Yeah, oh, really? I didn't get that feeling when we were in the conference center. I felt like they were hanging on his every word, and you know that they were expecting such greatness from him that they would take anything to just, you know, laugh hysterically about what he said, you know. And for those of you who didn't watch conference, seriously, they were laughing constantly through his entire talk, and none of it was funny, you know.
No, it was just, I mean, I hate to use, it was a kiss-ass move. It was a total kick-ass move. We're just going to make this guy. We already think he's great, and we're going to let him know how great we think he is. And we're just going to do the most appropriate thing we can think of right now, which is to just flutter with laughter. We're just all these little busy bees of women, and we're just this little hive, and we can't contain ourselves being around such greatness, and we just, oh, it's like eating the vapors or something.
I'm sorry, you guys are harsh.
I know. Well, I'm not even going to apologize for being harsh. That was my experience. I was.
You don't have to apologize. You're just fine.
It was. Yeah, creepy. It was creepy.
Yeah, the whole thing was very condescending, and the way that he had such a positive reception. The thing that made me so sad is that the whole idea is that I think that talk was actually helpful for people, and that's what makes me the most sad.
My mom and my sister said it was their most favorite. And because I had mentioned, like, that's actually when I started to get bummed out. And because it was kind of like the tide changed, like, it all became real to me. That feeling of being so inadequate, it all came rushing back and it just bummed me out. And they were like, what? That was our favorite. And I remember, I don't know if it was, I think Robin, you said this after when we were standing in the outer areas, and you said, how many women do you think actually found that as the most help, like that was their talk? And at first I kind of thought, that's just that's a typical response. But then when I had both my mom and my sister convey that message to me independently, I don't know how much of it is just simply because he's in the first presidency, because he's the priesthood holder, because he's the rock star, because he's the Harrison Ford, because whatever. But I was just kind of like, really? I thought that it was, I mean, I made so many notes in here. You know, he gives this whole recitation of the printing on the back of the Willy Wonka golden ticket and how, you know, we can't keep expecting to have this golden ticket in our lives. We've got to start appreciating what we have now. And I wrote, you know, use this golden ticket metaphor over and over again to explain women's desire. There is no
and it's from a children's book, so it's condescending, you know.
And then I thought, supremely condescending. All metaphors are about flowers and golden tickets. Are we too stupid to understand anything else?
Wow, you guys had a much different reaction than I did.
Just come out and be honest.
I know. Heather, bring it to another level. Take us to another level, because I do have this bummed me out. This bummed me out big time.
I'll defend him by saying that I think he kind of has that tone whenever he talks to the church in general. I don't think it was just, excuse me, because he was talking to women, but I don't know. What were you going to say, Heather?
I think that there is a lot of it's even spoken pressure on women in the church with the Julie Beck Women Who Know BS. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Women who know fix perfect dinners, and women who know send their children to church wearing perfect clothing and that kind of thing. And women who know have absolutely no life outside of their family. Like, that was the part of that talk that just really threw me over the edge, is women who know to limit their outside interests and keep their focus on their family. I think there's a lot of pressure in the church on women to measure up and show the way they show their devoutness and devotion to God is to have a perfect home and perfect children. And I kind of felt like Uchtdorf was coming in and saying, calm down about that. Do you know what I mean? Like, he was saying, be patient with yourself. You're not perfect.
Right.
Don't
and
kill
that
yourself.
Reason, like, kind of, I thought the talk was actually a good message. Like, I thought that it's something that a lot of Mormons need to hear in some ways, you know, because I feel like a lot of Mormons do exactly the things that he's telling them not to do, which is to think about that they focus so much on the future that they neglect being happy in the present and doing the things that will make them happy today, things like that. So there were a lot of things that I really liked. I don't know.
But maybe the problem is he ought to talk to Julie Beck and have her kind of change some of her talks. Because to have her go ahead and give those talks and to where that seems to be accepted and okay, then he turns around and he says, you know, so many of our messages are exactness, precision, and all this kind of thing. Then he turns around with this kind of a talk where he then belittles us.
So if it's like good cop, bad cop. You know, she's bad cop and he's good cop.
Yeah, and he's good cop. But the thing is they're mixed messages. They're giving us mixed messages. And it's not fair.
He gave several mixed messages, I thought. and directly tied to that, one, I agree that the overall message of the talk, which is women, be gentle on yourselves, don't take this, you know, don't punish yourselves for not doing all these things, et cetera, except the manner in which this information is given to us is condescending, because he uses several examples of step two is learn the difference between good sacrifices and foolish sacrifices. And he gave examples of, you know, a good sacrifice is staying up all night and helping your child with
an ill child,
a sick child with something. And a foolish sacrifice would be, you know, trying to perfect your pot holders and cross stitching them and et cetera, when those are also the things, like you were saying, the conflicting messages that women have been taught. This is what represents and proves how much you love your family, et cetera, et cetera. And then he talks about don't try to be perfect, but keep trying to be perfect, but strive for perfection. The Lord wants you to strive for perfection. Don't be,
yes,
so pissed, you know, don't be so hard on yourself that you can't make it, but don't stop trying.
Well, yeah. And he talked about, you know, don't forget the why of the gospel. And, you know, like I said, on its face, a lot of these things were good. And I actually had mentioned, you know, stop punishing yourselves and some of those things. But like I said, the context really messes it up in how this is going on. But anyway, so don't forget the why of the gospel. He goes on to talk about how the what and how of the gospel are still important. The why is what brings the joy. So then talking about all these things. So basically, if you find the gospel burdensome, it's your fault because you've forgotten the why.
Absolutely. It's not because the church, you know, created this system in which you have these lofty expectations for yourself. It's your fault.
Yeah, I can see that.
Like I said, it was a bummer. I really wanted to kind of feel the essence of all this wonderfulness that is Uchtdorf. And I just, I felt like that I would never measure, I could never exist in this institution. I felt very much like I did, you know, the Sunday before I left, which is I will self-destruct in this organization. I will never fit in. I will never be able to accomplish the spirit of things, the letter of things. You know, I just, it was so overwhelming. And then with all of that, the laughter and just that, almost, I think I even wrote, women worship this man. Like, I'm sure it would have been the same. Well, maybe it wouldn't. I don't know. If any other member of the first presidency had been up there, God, I mean, can you imagine if it was Thomas S. Monson giving this message, how different it would have been? And then when the meeting was over, just the waving and the standing and the, you know, it was kind of like, you know, see me, don't forget me not. Oh God.
I used to like that flower. I really used to like that flower.
I didn't plant it in Farmville ever again.
But you know I have to say, you know, I'm a bit older. I don't know. I'm not quite sure how much older I am than you guys, but I've been around the block a few times and I listened intently. I was a temple worker. I had three children under the age of three. I was raising them, you know, little soldiers, perfect. Everything was perfect. And honestly, those talks, I would feel that way. I wave my arms and be happy and woohoo. And then I go home and be completely broken down because I felt so, I just didn't feel up to the task of what they were asking me to be. And I honestly, that was part of my downfall, or upfall, whatever you want to talk about. Mm-hmm. But I remember being on my stomach, screaming and crying into the floor with just depression and anxiety and knowing that I couldn't be who they all wanted me to be. And I look at these, I look at my mom and my sisters and my friends, and I just think, you know, gosh darn it, they're having to deal with that like I did. Luckily, I got out. But to hear these talks like Uchtdorf's, it just puts that pressure on the perfection value that you can never, ever really, truly live up to. So fake it or get out. and I chose to get out. And I've been happier, but it was a long, hard road for me to listen to those kind of talks over and over and over again, to know that I could never measure up to what they were telling me I needed to be.
That's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
We all know that. We all. I remember sitting in, you know, those kinds of meetings and just sobbing, and my parents are just like beaming because they think I'm so filled with the Spirit. But it was just absolute, just this dreaded feeling of I'm not worth. I will never be able to feel the way I'm supposed to feel. Not take away all the lists and the this and the that and the check off. I can do all that stuff. I can hopefully try and do all that stuff. But this mythical feeling of joy that's supposed to come with all of this, I knew never would exist for me. And that's what was so devastating.
Well, I remember being in what I called the fog, the fear, obligation, and guilt. And it wore me down. And I just, you know, I look around, like I said, and see the women around me listening to this. And, you know, he's the big superstar, rock star. He's got the message from God. It is so compromising, at least in my mind. I look back and I just think, you know, all the years that I let go of this, I didn't let go of the perfection, and I didn't really center myself and find out who I really was and what I needed to do in order to feel at peace with who I am, because I kept trying to live up to the standard that I could never, ever, ever live up to.
So, and I think your experience is what so many Mormon women experience a lot. I know my mom really feels that that same burden in the church, but I think that a lot of Mormon women, as we said earlier, they think that the problem is with them. The reason they're not happy is they're not trying hard enough, or they're just, you know, for whatever reason, they just don't measure up to this ideal that has been set before them. And so they internalize the guilt and the shame, and they think that it's because of them, not because maybe the institution is not communicating a good ideal for them to strive for.
Well, I think if you can go back to your statement of the separate but equal, I mean, the feeling that Cindy just described, that's what's wrong with separate but equal. It's not. There's a huge divide, and it's a soul defeating feeling to be presented with this so-called equalness, and yet, why don't I feel equal? Why doesn't this feel right? Why am I not happy to drink out of this fountain or speak in this meeting or say this prayer? Or it's a holistic soul destroyer.
Well, and here a male, you know, can have moments of glory and in leadership positions within the church. They can see the difference that they make in the church sphere. But women, as kind of like Uchtdorf said, her place is in the home, and so she doesn't ever get recognition or any kind of thanks for what she does in the home, because nobody sees it the way a male gets to be seen for all of his contributions to the church.
Well, you know, this kind of brings the hair on the back of my neck. I, as a woman that's raised three children and then in my 40s had another child, I've been a stay-at-home mom for, let's say, 25 years. And I just always felt like I was just below the top. I was just under, and I never really felt validated. It was probably just the way I felt, but I had to be subservient. I had to be clean. I had to take care of my children. I had to have the prayers. I had to do the family home evening. And if I didn't, there was something wrong with me. And it wore me down and wore me down and wore me down. And I, you know, boy, surprise, I raised three amazing children. And the last few years of their life, they've been out of the church. So when I even think about the talk that Sister Thompson talked about, cleave unto your covenants, and she tells us about the blessings, that you're going to have by cleaving unto those covenants, guess what, guys? I have received those blessings, and I completely let go of all my covenants.
So you've received the happiness and joy and
absolutely,
all of that.
I think it's a mind, what do you call it? I can't even say that word, but a mind, you know, cluster.
A mind F word?
because my family is, they have been waiting for the last 10 years to watch my marriage fall apart, watch mm-hmm. my children go get on drugs and everything happen. And so they can say, see, this is what happens.
Right.
And it didn't happen.
Oh my gosh, how can you be happy outside of the church? I don't understand.
My goodness. And if it happens to you when you're in the church, it's a trial. But if it happens to you outside of the church, it's a curse.
Right.
It's a consequence.
Yep. Yes, it's a consequence of your actions for not being, for not cleaving onto your covenants. So when I was listening to her talk, and I'm sorry, I'm going back to her talk.
No, that's okay. Go for it.
That was really compromising for me, even kind of a double bind for me, because I don't think anyone in their right mind really truly does keep all their covenants 100%. Okay, so what happens if you don't keep those? I know everyone says, yes, I do this, and yes, I do this when they're in their interview with their bishop. But I mean, really? Did we really all keep our covenants? I don't know. It was always hard on me to go into that interview and say, yes, I do. And I knew I was lying.
You probably weren't lying as much as you think you were.
I would tell my bishop or my state president, yeah, I'm trying. But in the back of my mind, I knew everyone else was doing the same thing I was, but proclaiming that they were living that law to the fullest extent and judging me by that. I don't know.
I think some of the covenants are set up to where I think anyone would question whether or not they are living them to the fullness. You know what I mean? Like the law of consecration. You can always give more until they've sucked every little bit dry, right?
Well, and
but what's giving more? I mean, what is it? What are they expecting you, and how do you answer that honestly?
Right. Exactly. So you're set up to fail on that one.
Exactly.
Well, and because it's in the temple, we can't really talk about it with each other. What does that covenant mean? Things like that. So we can't even, you know, have a postmortem in which we figure out, oh, is this how it is for you? Well, this is how it is for me. But we can't talk about it because it's in the temple.
Yeah, definitely. I wanted to hit on, if this is an okay time to interrupt, mm-hmm. the prayer. I think everybody was so ready to be done by the time we hit the closing prayer. So I wasn't really paying attention, and I think we were putting away our notebooks and not really taking notes. And then there was one like sentence that just stood out to me, where it was said, "We put our hearts on the altar." And
that
really bothered me. So I just wanted to bring that out because it seemed to be referencing blood sacrifice. And blood sacrifice is a real big issue for me. So anyway, there we go.
Yeah, me too.
Well, I wonder what was meant by that.
Like using the heart as a metaphor for your will, like doing what the Lord wants you to do, like putting your life in His hands.
Okay, you're probably right. Yeah.
And it sounds really righteous. So if you're trying to put yourself out there.
But if you think about it, put your heart on the altar, and who has the knife up above?
Abraham.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
angel's going to call you back.
Before we wrap this up, we should probably talk about the fact that some of us were able to attend in person.
Yes.
Yeah. So Alisa was able to secure tickets for all of us to attend in person, and unfortunately, I was unable to go along, and so was Cindy. But why don't you guys who went? Why don't you talk about? I mean, we have talked about a little bit about the experience, but was there anything else you wanted to add about being there?
Well, Heather, I think this might have something to do with the difference in, I think, Uchtdorf's address, maybe, because it seemed like it didn't affect you in nearly the way it affected us. And I think the fact that we were there right in the front center, we couldn't...
With laughter and surround sound all around us.
Yeah, we couldn't easily leave without making a huge ruckus. And so I think it felt a lot more threatening.
Well, and it was all, I felt very, being in that center of kind of like that womb of laughter, I guess is what you could call it, and not getting it, not getting the joke. It was so deafening.
It was uncomfortable.
I loved being there. It's a gorgeous building. I love art. There's beautiful pieces of art on the wall. They've got some gorgeous sculptures in there, and you know, being in the conference hall, or the, what would you call that? Is that the tab? I mean, it's got the big old tabernacle thingy.
It's this conference center.
Right. And it was backlit in a soft, huge magenta that would ebb and flow in so many tones, and that was, you know, and that was beautiful, and it was exciting. And I didn't have other than the kind of the initial panic attack where Robin's like, do you need to go? Do we need to leave? Are you going to be okay? I think it was really kind of nice to be back in something that is still familiar to me in so many ways. And I can't say that I didn't, I mean, if the opportunity arose to go again, I would definitely go again, and not with the intent of nitpicking, because I do want to continue to find good in the religion that I was raised in, even though it's caused me so much pain and, you know, depression and all of the things that I think we can all relate to. But there were, I think, being there and experiencing the reaction of others and just that emotional energy was something I was not prepared for. I was not prepared for that. Just being in the conference center did kind of give me a flashback. It was like post-traumatic stress almost. And that was easily resolved with some narcotics, I won't lie. I wasn't, it's hard to recall that kind of feeling, that kind of, it's like when you see a police officer in your rearview mirror and you wonder if you've been speeding and your whole body goes to absolute marshmallow and you're just kind of sick to your stomach. I mean, you can't replicate that emotion unless there's a cop in your rearview mirror. And then, and that was kind of the feeling of just that so much LDS-ness.
Right.
You can't replicate it. You can't, it's like the pain of childbirth. You forget it. And then when it happens again, you're like, oh yeah, that's it.
I have to be honest with you. I had every good intention to go that night, and I was trying to find every excuse to not go.
That's okay.
Seriously, I was having some, like you said, post-traumatic stress. And it was just, I had to sit and listen to myself and think, okay, I'm not really comfortable going there and dealing with that. And not, and I don't trust myself to not stand up and just turn around to everybody and say, this is all bull, you know.
I was afraid I was going to get a testimony, so don't worry.
I think for me, as Heather mentioned, I'm the one who got the tickets because I'm still actively attending the church, even though I wouldn't count myself as a believer. The thing that I think most of my fear and anxiety came out before we went into the conference center, because I was like, okay, I'm going to be with Robin and Amy, and they're going to want me to talk a certain way, but I'm going to be in this context where I'm supposed to perform Mormonism like I do at church, you know, and it is a performance for me.
Wow.
And I was like, this is going to cause a clash, you know, am I going to feel like stressed out, like trying to be who I want to be for these two different groups at the same time. So I was stressed out about that before the meeting, but in the actual conference center, everything was fine. I was just able to be myself and not worry and stress about other people eavesdropping or listening in conversations. So that was nice. The only other weird thing was like how hushed everybody got when Thomas S. Monson came in and everybody stood up and nobody spoke. It became dead silent. And then when he left, everybody was waving to him and taking pictures and standing again. That was just kind of weird for me, but yeah.
I'm glad you said that, Elisa, because I remember at one point you turned to me and said, I'm going to sing this hymn because I like it, or something like that. And I'm like, you don't need my permission to sing a hymn.
I like the hymns. I like singing.
I have to say, the way I watched it, it was awesome. I was telling you guys before, in my bath with a glass of wine. Yeah, I mean, that's the only way I could. I could kind of just get everything into me and think and open my mind, and my husband's taking notes, and I just thought, oh, this is good.
I think that's fine. When I proposed the idea to Heather, I was like, is this going to be too creepy for people, or is it going to be subversively cool? And we went with subversively cool.
Totally.
I thought it was subversively cool. I was very bummed that I didn't get to attend with you guys.
Robin, do you want to talk about your little streak of the enforcer that came out in you?
Oh yeah. Well, yes.
Uh-oh, Robin.
Well, yeah, I think, well, enforcer. And then also I think a little bit, because I think how Amy, you mentioned, I was saying, you know, we can leave, we don't need to stay here. So the one that's kind of a advocate or facilitator, recognizing I should have expected some of those emotions in that context, but I didn't. And so I was a little surprised. And so my thought is, you know, when you're someplace like that, you just kind of fade into the woodwork and just play along and get along and go along kind of thing. And so when I saw kind of the other things going on for you guys, and to where it seemed to be a little more obvious, I got a little nervous because I didn't want to be kicked out.
You were like metaphorically slapping our hand.
No slapping. Although I was nervously
glove, Robin.
I was nervously going through my purse, and I think I let a few shushes out.
Oh no. Don't say.
And then I apologize, because I don't mean to be the enforcer at all, but I noticed that was maybe my PTSD or my thing, is that, you know, because I know when I was in the church, I never stood out as a troublemaker, even though I had all sorts of crazy things in my head. I knew good enough to keep my mouth closed until I left, or at least not good enough, because I guess it works differently for different people, but I was always afraid to rock the boat, and I recognized I returned to that.
While you were there.
Being at the conference.
Well, that's very interesting. Yes. Well, one more thing before we wrap this up. So I, this morning, wanted to re-listen to everything so it was fresh in my memory for the podcast. And I went to LDS.org to look up the General Relief Society meeting. And on the homepage is Elder Uchtdorf's talk, you know, in that little scroll thing they do. And then when you go to the actual page for the conference, for the talk, for the meeting, Elder Uchtdorf's talk is listed first, and that really bugged me.
That bothered me a lot too. I was like, oh my gosh, you know, they're positioning, like on the banner, like you said, where it scrolls and it shows the images, like it doesn't even mention that he gave the talk at the Relief Society broadcast. It just says forget me nuts and click here, that kind of a thing,
right?
So that really bothered me, that again, it's reinforcing this idea that the priesthood leader is the one that you all come to hear, and he's the one whose message we take seriously. Which, by the way, that made me think of I was talking to my mom after the next day, and she had watched it in a church building, and she had a friend next to her. And during Barbara Thompson's talk, the third talk, when they plugged the Daughters in My Kingdom book again, the woman sitting next to her leaned over to my mom, was like, is this an infomercial or what? You know? And I thought it was interesting that she probably wouldn't have said that if Uchtdorf had plugged it in his talk, because then it would have been, oh, I'm criticizing my priesthood leader. Like, it's okay to criticize, like, the Relief Society presidency, because they're not real leaders, but we can't criticize Uchtdorf or anything like that.
Oh, heavens no. I still go back to the place where, you know, where we're all the brethren. If the women are that important, why aren't all of them there? The ones that are always there at conference.
Like the whole 12 and the 70s and everything.
Yeah, I mean, I know you guys were there, and I was looking. They had the song going, and I was looking at all the seats, and they were empty, empty chairs. There's lots of empty chairs. And what kind of message does that give to the women, how important they are?
Well, And they give out the, in church, they gave out the Daughters in My Kingdom book to all of us in the Relief Society. Why don't they give them to the men? I mean, do the women need to be told that they're valuable over and over again? Or don't we need to communicate to the men that the history of the Relief Society is interesting and worth studying and things like that? That was another thing that kind of bothered me.
Yeah, I the absence of the brethren really, really bothered me. And I hear what you're saying with the book too, but they claim that we are forget-me-nots or whatever you want to call us, but why? Okay. So if we are that important that you don't want to forget about us, why aren't all the brethren there supporting the women conference or the women's meeting? It's not even a conference. It's a meeting.
And why aren't these same messages about the importance of women, et cetera, and not being hard? Why isn't, I remember writing in my note, why aren't the men hearing this? It's interesting to know. It's interesting to wonder how different the church could be, how much better it could be. I mean, if that's, of course, that pie in the sky, perfect thinking, if it was just the way we wanted it. But it could be so different. It could be so much better with the women taking more of a, if they had more authority and they were honored more, and we weren't made fun of for cross stitching potholders that were so important last week in homemaking.
I totally agree with you. That, absolutely.
All right, ladies. Well, I think with that we should probably wrap this session up, and hopefully we'll continue these interesting conversations on the website MormonExpression.com. Thank you for being with us, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
All right. Good evening and welcome to another episode of Mormon Expression. We're going to be reviewing the priesthood session of conference. What is this? October 2011. And I'm going to be your host, Glenn Ostland. And I'm joined in my home tonight by two friends of mine who are in the ward in Bloomington with me. We've got Jake Frost, who's actually going to be going by his wife's last name tonight, Jake Schertz. How you doing, Jake?
Great. Wonderful.
Hey, you did that really well.
Thank you. That was good.
Yeah. And sitting by his side, we have Adam.
Hi.
And Adam, you've been with us before. You were on the Depression
Yes, podcast, yes. That was really fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep, enjoyed it.
Fantastic. And then through Skype, we're joined by a new addition to Mormon Expression. We've got Chris.
Hello, everyone. I'm glad to lose my Mormon Expression virginity here.
And we're glad to help you lose it, Chris. This all seems so vaguely familiar. And Brent?
Yes.
Brent Malone is coming in. How are you doing, Brent?
Good, holding down the east side for you.
You are, aren't you? Well, we're all kind of on the east side. Where are you at, Chris?
I'm actually located in Utah, so.
Okay, so you're Utah. The rest of us are Midwest, Indiana, Michigan, and Utah.
That's funny. My wife saw a tweet online that said, I'm not used to the East Coast priesthood session time. I better load up on caffeine.
Right, yeah. It's kind of late for us. So
make sure that caffeine's cold. Make sure it's cold.
Right.
That's right.
Why's that?
Hot drinks are
hot
bad
drinks,
for the
right?
body.
You can have cold caffeine.
Yeah, I've been out for too long. I forgot about
Come
that.
Come on, you're slipping. More fellowshipping for you.
More fellowshipping for me. All right. Well, let's jump right in, shall we? Let's start with the opening prayer. Chris, you had something you wanted to say about the opening prayer.
Yeah, in the opening prayer, he was talking about the wonder of the technology that allowed this meeting to be broadcast all around the world and into huts in Africa. And I really wondered if there was any documentation on whether it was really being broadcast into a hut in Africa somewhere. I mean, I'm sure the technology is possible, but I wonder if the church has expanded to that depth yet.
I have no idea. I know we lost the signal in our building, so,
Yeah, we did a couple of times.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess if they had a radio, it'd have to be pretty big
right.
radio, though.
Right,
I think it was done through the Spirit, so.
Right, well.
Good. Fantastic.
Fantastic.
All right, so after the opening prayer, where did we go from there?
We had Elder Holland versus Satan was the talk.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and I have to say that because Elder Holland spoke, that means that I lost the which apostle is going to speak bet with my wife, so.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So who wants to? So Chris, why don't you start off and tell us a little bit about Elder Holland?
Well, like it was mentioned, it was Holland versus Satan in this one.
Score one, Holland.
Yeah. really talking about how Satan is real and that, basically the summary of the talk is because Satan is real, we need missionaries. Yeah. So I want you.
Interesting. Right. That's like a propaganda poster right there.
He didn't make he wasn't pretending that it wasn't propaganda. At the beginning, he said, think of this as a recruitment speech for missionaries.
Yeah, he was pretty...
So, Chris, you say that almost as if you think you're saying that kind of tongue in cheek, like you think that Satan isn't real.
That's true. I don't believe he's real. Okay. So,
Brant, what was your take on the Holland talk?
I can understand his whole concept of let's really go after Satan and let's rile the troops together. I understand what he's saying, but for me personally, I'm sitting here going. Are we going to fight a battle here? Or are we going on the football field? I wasn't really sure where he was coming at. I thought he made some good remarks about missionaries and how we just need to get out there and do missionary work. But it really did sound a lot like a coach trying to pep up a team before they did a homecoming game.
Well, I especially thought it was interesting that he said, we will need tens of thousands of missionaries in the months and years ahead, almost as if he's foreshadowing that, we're going to need this extra boost in the future.
Yeah, why is that?
I didn't catch that.
Well, I didn't catch that part, and I've been thinking a little bit about it, and church. Statistically, the church. Church membership in the United States, net growth is pretty much zero. It's essentially the same, the same amount of people are coming into the church as leaving it. And I really think that the general authorities are, and the church administration in general feels threatened by that, by the fact that the church really isn't growing, especially with, the younger generation really isn't. But it really isn't holding on or grasping onto religious ideas or religious concept with much.
So you
fervor.
Think it's about bolstering the membership?
I mean, I think that's one of the. I think that's a significant pressure that the church is under.
Yeah,
and that bleeds into what Elder Holland was focused on, and the focus on missionary work in general, and I feel like especially pointed was like the dichotomy between us versus Satan, church members versus the world.
Yeah,
like,
that came up a lot.
Right. Yeah.
So is that an indication that Satan's winning? That the numbers are decreasing?
Maybe that's why he had the rally cry. I don't know.
Yeah.
But isn't religion decreasing among teenagers anyways? I mean, it's not just Mormonism. It's there have been a lot of one book that in particular called Almost Christian that came out talking about this lack of spirituality within teenagers. So I don't know if it's a Mormon thing or not. I mean, I know there's been numbers out there that say membership is declining a little bit as far as converts versus 8-year-old baptisms, but it seems like it's everyone in particular, not just Mormons.
Yeah.
I think that's true across the board, yeah.
What'd you think, Adam?
Oh, I was just going to say the thing that Jake was saying reminded me of, BYU fumbling at the end zone. Maybe they're a little worried.
Against the U?
Yeah, U's? Against the U.
I see. Okay. You just wanted to put that in, didn't you?
It's a good metaphor.
Okay. for just about anything?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Got it. The only thing I really wanted to say about this, I've never really understood the urgency of missionary work, and especially when you compare it to like a battle with Satan that he knows he's ultimately going to lose. And when you look at the life of Christ, he kind of let Satan win. He kind of took it, let himself be crucified, let himself be beaten. We've got this story in the Book of Mormon about the anti-Nephi Lehis who just kind of bent down and let themselves be slaughtered. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't seem really consistent with this rah-rah coach, get out there and fight against Satan thing. I don't really get
I don't think it's a very logical battle to be fighting anyway. If you look at the context of church membership as a percentage of world population, like, we're not trying to... I don't know if... We're not trying to convert the world. I mean, if that's our goal, we are. But the thing is, if that's our goal, like, we are failing miserably. And there's, I mean, I just feel like we're setting ourselves up for failure if that's what we're really going for.
Yeah. Well, I think that the authorities might recognize this, and I think that is reflected in this particular meeting. I mean, we had two big talks that was a real push toward, you know, stand up, speak out, you know, let's get out, let's get the message out.
Yeah. Now, in addition to the announcement of like subsidized housing for senior missionaries and greater flexibility for their mission possibilities, all of that, you know, kind of went into this pitch for missionary work.
And the condescending attitude towards grandmothers hovering over their grandchildren.
Oh, yeah.
But yes. We don't need to nitpick all of this stuff. So,
right.
All right. That's Holland's talk. Any final words on Holland? No. Okay, then Keith B. McMullen, who was the second counselor in the presiding bishopric. And I've got to say, I don't know if Jake, you or Adam noticed, but I was just in stitches like within the first 5 minutes because he kept saying duty. And I felt like a Beavis and Butthead thing where every time he said duty, I laughed a little bit harder and laughed a little bit harder. And at the end, you know, he mentioned that we should put away our childish things, but I couldn't help it. Like, he kept saying duty, duty, duty. Wait, it just was funny to me.
Put away childish things, because I had my iPad out. Should I put that away?
You probably should have, yeah. Oh. I mean, later on, I was playing games on my iPhone. Oh. But
dang it.
Yeah. So
it was on prayer. I was reading about prayer.
Right. So, Jake, why don't you start us out on this one? What were your thoughts on Elder McMullen?
Right. Well, I mean, and I think this is to be expected from a priesthood session, but it kind of had this implicit, like, well, no, it wasn't implicit. It was explicit, you know, assertion of how special we are and the special mantle we have and the, you know, how chosen we are. But the thing is, like, even with that kind of language, which I find a little off-putting, because it's like, we didn't all come here to, like, pat ourselves on the back. I mean, I guess we did, but I don't like to do that.
I'll pat you on the back.
Anyway, thank you. But what I'm saying is, I feel like he kind of took the implication of that to kind of a constructive place. Like, what he was really pushing for was real, actual service and, like, in the youth and having the youth serve other people and be nice. And so, you know, I was for that.
I shouldn't have had you take on the last name Schertz. I knew this was going to happen. You're having to be constructive about everything now. That's what happens when you take your
last name. Right, the shirts, they're apologists, what can I say?
Right.
I thought, for this one, I thought it was interesting that there was an equivalence that he made between manhood and the priesthood. And that's something I've always really liked about the church is the rites of passage that it gives for young boys to say, this is, you know, now you're deacon, now you're teacher, now you're priest, and in taking this responsibility, you have become a man.
Yeah.
And so yeah, I thought that was a nice touch. One thing that stuck out to me for dumb reasons, though, was it seems like, you know, do your duty and God will bless you. And if you do, you'll be popular with the ladies.
Yeah, he did add that, right?
He did say that.
And you'll be praised of your parents, and you'll be praised of everybody around you, and you'll be popular with everybody, but especially the ladies. And then a little bit later, he talked about being unpretentious.
Yeah, the exact phrase was, young women will adore the young men if they're righteous.
Yeah, right.
Because we all love a Peter priesthood, don't we?
Right. So what else did you think about this, Brant?
Honestly, I kind of zoned out, but the thing that struck me the most was he's got to have one of the best voices for speaking. He sounded like he was the music and the spoken word guy, just the way that he did his intonation and everything. But I really like the concept of we need to focus more on serving. And that was stressed a couple of times through this session, but I really like that. Focus more on serving and not so much about sometimes the petty little things that we get wrapped up with.
All right. Adam?
Good. I was reading, so.
So you weren't paying attention?
Not during that one. No, turned it off.
Oh, just like a light switch?
Yeah, like a light switch.
Okay. You know, I think Jake and Chris, you both mentioned youth, and this was clearly the intended audience.
Obligatory Aaronic priesthood talk.
Right.
That has to happen.
And it just reminded me of being a kid and hearing this stuff and just eating it up. And it was very rousing and encouraging. And I could remember feeling that as a kid. And I would have eaten it up again if I was a kid sitting in there. I was looking around at the youth and trying to imagine whether or not they felt that same type of excitement about being Mormon that I did as a kid. But yeah, I mean, it was a performance. I mean, I just, you know, you mentioned the voice, Brant did.
Yeah.
You know, he's got that voice. He's got that performance down. I'm a little more jaded about it now because it just seems so fake. Like I imagined him walking away going, nailed it.
Well, okay. But look, you've all seen the people that have just got up there and they have no clue how to deliver a talk or a speech. And it just is boring. So at least he put some of his own flair in it. I mean, it was a little over the top, but it's better than someone just reading it.
It was rousing.
Agreed.
Yeah, I agree. It was rousing. Yep. All right. The next we had W. Christopher Waddell of the 70.
What would you put his age at? He looked young to me.
Yeah.
He did look young.
Late 30s, early 40s.
Yeah.
Yeah, Adam, did you wake up for this one?
Was there another one in here? I think I was still on the bench.
Yeah, no, he's the one that he started off talking about missionaries being released, and then he turned it into a metaphor for the premortal existence, and how every move we make is
every breath we take too.
Yeah, directed by God.
Yeah,
he told the story about the missionary from Spain who got redirected to the U.S. and met the semi-active guy who thought that his mission was a failure and found out he converted
and
his
the
father.
Dad. Okay, yeah. I remember some of that seeping in.
In between Angry Birds?
No, actually, it was. I was reading about contemplative prayer, but, okay. You know.
All right.
Well, I thought, if I may. I remember looking, when I was listening to this talk, just about... The thing that stood out to me was when he talked about missionary work, like the only measures of success were listing off the ordinances that the people that the guy had baptized, his children had participated in.
Yeah.
So it was just like they're active in the church, they were baptized, they went to the temple, they went on a mission, they were sealed
check,
in the temple.
Check,
right?
Check.
So it's just checking off these ordinances and like this is the measure of success for missionaries.
Right.
And that is the measure of success for missionaries. And they try and water that language down for missionaries that are struggling. But, like, I don't know. I just feel like so many missionaries have this immense – and I had this immense psychological and emotional stress all the time because that is the measure of success. And they always say if you work, then you have success. But I never saw any correlation between the effort that I put in and the measure of success that the church endorsed in terms of missionary work. You know, the kind of check mark – listened to lessons, went to church, was baptized, received the priesthood, that type of thing. So anyway, I'm kind of bitter against it, so I kind of hated that.
Okay, so Jake, Stephen, or Covey, how would you measure that? How would you measure success then?
As a missionary?
Yeah. Just curious.
Just being happy every day.
So like a happiness scale every night takes some kind of a psychological assessment?
Yeah, I guess so.
0 to 10, right. How happy are you to them?
Give them happy faces. And right. Have them like rate the, you know, right. Like if it's a big smile, a small smile, a straight line.
How big is your happy?
Slash line. Today it's contempt.
And it'll be like, you know, it'll be like rate your pain. It'll be like rate your happy.
Yeah.
And you'll still have the faces.
I like it.
I can do that. I can get into that.
We could do colors.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, I think just, you know, monitoring your own personal growth and how you've changed throughout the mission. And if you feel like you did a good job and if you're a better person this day than you were yesterday, then that's success.
Subjective report. I like it, too.
It would make for a difficult anecdote in a conference talk.
Yeah.
But I kind of like that as well.
Yeah.
Well, and I hope I'm not getting too jaded. I think I'm just a little cranky today. But it's always bothered me about how that's – the only whenever you hear a missionary story, they go through that checklist, and it always bothered me because I didn't see a lot of that on my own personal mission. As a matter of fact, I have no clue the people I talk to or taught or baptized what they're doing because they're on the other side of the world. So that being said, I'm kind of sitting here saying, well, if if they didn't meet these criteria, are you saying that this person that I taught wasn't a good person? Even if they might have changed their life around, even if they might have developed a close relationship with God, are you saying that they're not good because they didn't meet those criteria? And it just it bothered me a little bit.
Well, no, I totally agree, because at the beginning, I mean, he talks about this guy who went inactive in the church because he felt like his mission was a failure. And why did he feel like his mission was a failure? Because he didn't meet these criteria that were set up. He didn't baptize one person, and he, you know, didn't have that much success. And, you know, the ending of this story turned out happy because he found out that the one guy he baptized went on to be a stake president. But how many other people are there in the world, missionaries, who came home and didn't have success and leave the church because they feel like they were a failure? There's a lot of pressure on that.
Exactly. Well, and you're on the right path, Brant. You just need to keep doing the podcast, slowly go semi-inactive, and then eventually the Lord will bring one of those South Koreans to you, and you'll get to hear the story of the people who you touched while you were there. But then the story ends, because we don't know what happened to the guy after that.
That I touched spiritually, not physically.
Well, those stories will stay private.
The one line I really did like was, he said, "Your mission will become sacred ground to you." And I really like that, because, you know, for me personally, anything involving Korea has just become a really soft spot for my heart. And I think that line for just about anyone who's, especially if you serve in a foreign country, it really is true.
Yeah.
But oh, no, I totally agree. No. Like, even with this meeting, you know, I went to Japan, and even though I don't believe anymore, it was nice to see a Japanese guy give the closing prayer. I was like, good for you. Good job.
Yeah.
Well, I agree with that, being able to, you know, have a soft spot for – I served a foreign mission. I served in Peru, but I felt like the kind of the pressures that the church puts on the missionaries in terms of success, in terms of working hard, and the sense of urgency, I think those pressures really inhibited my ability to connect with the culture there. Like, I would have had a much, much better experience and come to, like, love the country I was in instead of hating everything, you know, like, because, like, part of me just always kind of hated the country I was in because it represented everything that brought stress and, like, anxiety into my life.
No, I could totally see that.
But I don't know. Anyway, but what I'm saying is, it does help. Like, they're wonderful experiences living in a foreign country and doing this, that type of thing. I just think that the pressure, psychological, emotional, that the church puts on the missionaries inhibits that.
And I've heard a lot of people say the same thing, Jim.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, there was one thing that Christopher Waddell talked about that I found very problematic. He mentioned the story about the children of Israel being obedient, taking the lamb's blood and putting it on the doors, and it was the application of the lamb's blood. It wasn't just the sacrifice of the lamb's blood, but it was the application of the sacrifice, because and he made sure to say that this lamb's blood was representative of the atonement of Christ, but it was the application of the sacrifice, and if it wasn't for that application, the sacrifice would have been in vain. That just made me think, okay, so the Son of God, according to this story, the Son of God dying on the cross is in vain if we don't do stuff? That seems a little arrogant.
I think that in his particular metaphor, although he did mention that the lamb's blood represents the atonement ultimately, in this particular instance, I think he was using it more as the idea that your mission was a sacrifice, but unless you apply the things you learn from your mission, the sacrifice will be in vain. So, you know, he talked about the one guy who at the very beginning who fell away even after his mission because he felt like he was a failure, and his conclusion is that he failed to apply himself. And that we need to apply our sacrifice of a mission in order for it to be effective.
Okay.
Well, and it's like the off-chair thing about fasting, where if you fast without a purpose, you're just starving yourself for 24 hours. You're sacrificing for fasting, but the application is what do you do? I think that's what he was trying to get at.
But didn't he say that the blood was the blood, like, represented Christ's blood? It didn't represent our blood that we shed in the sacrifice of our mission. The blood was Christ's blood, like the atonement.
Didn't he say that? He did, in saying that, you know, the real meaning of this metaphor is that this blood was Christ. But in this other meaning, the sacrifice can be our mission or whatever.
Yeah, I think you guys are right. I probably missed that point because I was overextending the metaphor into ordinances and other things like that that I have beefs with in other areas. But yeah, you guys are reeling me in here, so that's what needs to be done. Moving on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, so right here at this point, we have a song where everyone sings.
Okay.
And can I just say, I really enjoy singing in priesthood. Do they like modulate down the songs so that they're in like a range that we can handle, like the men can handle, like lower? Because it seems like it's so much easier to sing songs in priesthood.
I think it's auto-tune.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
No, Chris, I agree with you. It really is something to be said for a bunch of people standing up, and I don't know what it was like in your buildings, but in my buildings it was much different than sacrament, where people actually wanted to sing and they sang loud and with pride, whereas sacrament's like a funeral dirge.
Yeah. Did you guys stand up?
Oh yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. I like that. Awesome. All right. Dieter F. Uchtdorf, right?
Yep.
And you talked about welfare. Who wants to take Uchtdorf?
Yeah, I actually
you woke up for this.
I woke up for this one.
All right, fantastic.
I came out of my super. It's that great tan that he has.
Is it?
Yeah. It wakes me up every time. One thing really stood out to me. I'm kind of jumping into the middle of the talk, but he said about sort of implementing these welfare principles. He said, "Do not always look to Salt Lake City, but, for example, to God, to your own heart, and to these principles, rather than
to the church handbook."
Yeah, that's what I extended it the other way that Glenn would extend it, and interpreted that as principles. I guess you'd go either way with that. But anyway, it was nice to hear. You know, you don't need to look to Salt Lake City for everything.
I like that.
I love that. I thought that was so refreshing.
I kind of had a problem with this. Well, the way that I see people in the church give to, like, outside, because the only service I feel like that we really know how to give is what the church calls service. So, like, service is going to the temple and serving the spirits of the people who are dead. Or home teaching, which means that we go and just kind of, like, spit out this half-baked spiritual message and take up an hour of people's time on a Sunday afternoon. Well,
right.
I mean, at its worst, right? But what were you saying?
Service that even is done for the welfare and things like that is always done within the church. So if you're like, yeah, I went and served at a soup kitchen, you know, that doesn't count as much as, oh, I went to the cannery and, you know, the bishop's storehouse.
Right. And so when I see people like church members, like if there's like a bum on the street or something and like a homeless person, like, so many times I've seen people like, well, I'll give him food, but I won't give him money because he'll just buy alcohol or something like that. Like, he doesn't...
I donate to fast offerings, and this helps people like that, so I've done my part.
Right. And so, and Elder Uchtdorf is kind of talking about the application of the church model, the Lord's way of welfare, which is on self-reliance. But the thing is, like, outside of the context of the church, like, who are we to really decide, like, what the limits or what level of self-reliance we are going to get out of these people before we'll give something to them, you know, like, does that make sense?
Yeah,
I'm saying?
No, I mean, this talk doesn't really mesh with my personal political views. You know, I think that, and it worries me that Mormons will take this and then use it to, you know, go all Tea Party and stuff and that sort of thing. But, you know, I think that for me, I think we need to look to help people in every way that we can, even if it includes, you know, just giving them a boost, you know, just a monetary donation. You know, I mean, we want to help them, you know, help themselves. But I think that first we need to be able to meet their needs.
Well, going along with a couple of thoughts, with other service such as soup kitchens compared to church-oriented service like the cannery. I know my dad has said that, and I've challenged him on this, and he stays firm, he will only donate to the church because in his mind, I know that the funds are going to be used honestly and appropriately compared to other organizations which he's donated to and scandals have come out. So that's one view that he takes, which I don't really agree with. But number two, I really like this refreshing concept of quit asking Salt Lake and start doing it yourself because of a couple things. First of all, so many Mormons have a reliance on Salt Lake. Well, we can't do anything until the brethren say so. And Uchtdorf kind of let himself a little out saying, well, you can follow the manuals. But still, I like it because what you do in Salt Lake City doesn't translate to what you do in Detroit, Michigan, and doesn't translate to what you might do in a place like South Africa. So it empowers these local organizations to do things that they think would be best. And that's one of the first times ever since Correlation that I've heard that.
Well, I totally agree. I think that's a great thing. One thing that I worried about was him mentioning that, hey, don't wait for the experts to solve your problems. Don't listen to the experts. You know, in the church, if there's a river going, we don't wait for the water to go down a little bit. We build a boat and we cross. And anyone who's played Oregon Trail knows that if you cock the boat and you go when the water's raging, you'll crash and lose an oxen and three axles.
And you might get dysentery.
And some bags of flowers. Some bags of flour. You'll lose those too.
Yeah, some flowers.
You know, and it seems like his approach is, hey, let's work harder, not smarter. You know, and that's kind of the feeling I got from it. You know, let's just work really, really hard, and that'll make up for everything. That'll take care of it all.
I do think it's an interest. I mean, this message of self-reliance is an interesting way to view God and to view a God who allows the Gila River to overflow in the first place and doesn't automatically send relief of his own accord, but expects people to just deal with it.
We're here to grow. That's why.
Or there's not a God, and this is just nature doing things.
Yeah.
And so there's people that are interpreting that as a God that's expecting self-reliance. It's just a fascinating way of taking things.
Sure.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's a talk about helping the needy, which I think is great. So you can't fault him for that.
Right.
We're trying to, apparently.
we're just exploring the message is all we're doing.
Exploration.
We're just exploring the message. Okay. Yeah. So, Henry B. Eyring, let's quickly explore his message because it was boring.
Yeah, my brain shut off on that one.
Yeah. I agree. Let me give you my summary of this one. Okay, let's see. It's that, you know, the priesthood is there for our preparation. And you may feel like you're inadequate, but don't worry, because the church basically runs on long, hard hours of humble incompetence.
Okay, wow.
Well, yeah, I mean, he did kind of talk about, like, all these experiences where he'd just run himself into the ground and then he'd like finally fall exhausted into bed and then somebody would be like, wait, we have to do one more thing. Like, why don't you get up and do this thing?
Mm-hmm. And like, and this thing,
right.
You know, I'm not an expert in this thing, but we did it anyway.
Yeah. And like, instead of being like a normal person, just being like, screw you, I'm going to bed. Like, don't get all self-righteous and crap on me. Anyway, sorry. Edit that. Anyway. But, you know.
For crap?
No, I edited that in my brain.
Okay.
Otherwise, it wouldn't have been crap. Anyway, so if they're getting all self-righteous and stuff, like, why don't you say, you know, screw you and just, like, forget about it. But instead, you just work yourself to death until somebody has to carry you to the hospital once you've died in the service of the church. Hmm. But, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I thought that was funny where, what was it? Was Kimball having like a heart attack or some kind of medical issue, like passed out or something?
Yeah, I don't know.
They picked him up by the chair and they were taking him out into the hall and he's like, oh, you know, I'm sorry to trouble you. Don't hurt your back while you're lifting him up. And they take him out to his office and he says, you should get back to the meeting. And so they go. They're like, well, the prophet said we got to be in that meeting. There must be some good reason to be there. I was going to wait for the paramedics, but we got to get to that meeting.
God wants us there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody loved that story. People really responded with the warm chuckle.
Yeah. Yeah.
Trying to understand what those warm chuckles meant, but
it was just,
Well, what stood out to me actually the most in the talk was really quite personal. That all the stories about making somebody, you know, younger, like a mentee, feel that they're needed. And I thought a lot of my dad, you know, involving me in a lot of stuff he did and making it feel like I was needed or wanted there. And now doing the same thing with my son, who's 4 years old, but wants to, you know, helped me fix my bike with his wooden, you know, screwdrivers.
Right.
So it just kind of inspired me, or edified, if you right. want to say.
Yeah.
Me to make sure I do that, even if it's something that, you know, I really don't need him to do something, but just to involve him in that.
So like a very functional, sociological function of the church.
Yeah.
To help people feel needed and raise them in that kind of sheltered environment where they feel like they have a home and a purpose.
I think that could be part of it. I think sometimes there actually are you know, tangible results from some of that.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I can see that.
Okay. Well, I thought another thing that he mentioned that was worthy of repeating would be that if you understand your own weaknesses, you'll be able to help others because you recognize, you know what it feels like to be helpless in a certain way. So
the thing he said that annoyed me the most was, you know, what you hear every once in a while, that if you do all that you can do, then the Lord will bless you, and, you know, you'll have what I don't even remember what he said after that, because I just was, you know, I've had those experiences where I felt like I was doing everything that I was supposed to be doing, and I just still felt empty in those times where I needed the comfort. You know,
Those stories don't make good conference talks, so no, we don't hear them.
I was baptized. I got the Spirit of the Holy Ghost, the Comforter, in times in my life when I needed the Comforter, and I got down on my knees to pray, send the Comforter, and it didn't come. And I wasn't sinning. I was doing everything that I was supposed to do. And so I hear a phrase like this from Eyring and think, okay, what is it that I wasn't doing? Why is it that the Comforter didn't come? I got tired of feeling that.
You needed the footsteps in the sand.
Oh, the footsteps in the sand.
That's what you needed.
Or the great parody poem, Butt Prints in the Sand, which I don't know if you're not familiar with Butt Prints in the Sand, Google it.
Yeah.
All right.
Oh, one more thing. He did say that, you know, you will hear this, the scripture that he quotes the third time, this conference, but that repetition equals inspiration. And if that's true, I've had a lot of inspiration in church.
Right, yeah, yeah.
I think he kind of meant that tongue-in-cheek, didn't he?
I think he did. That was the impression that I got.
He kind of had a sly smile when he said that.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah. Okay, President Monson, who never means anything tongue-in-cheek.
Actually, he did sound like his voice... It was different from yesterday, or from earlier this morning.
So you mean like his tongue really was in his cheek?
actually did sound like, did he have like a cough drop, or, I don't know, was it just me?
Well, apparently he was late to the first session today, and so there were some people speculating that maybe he had to get some dental work done, because it was really apparent to me that there was something going on in his mouth.
Yep, tongue in cheek.
Oh dear.
You know, something I feel about Monson watching him is I think he recognizes that he's not as witty as Hinckley was, and so that he has to do physical comedy now, where he'll do these crazy facial expressions, or, you know, rocking back and forth at the podium or something like that.
Like that opening, like, boy, there's a lot of people here.
Yeah, and then he just does this crazy look. You know, exaggeration.
You guys need to laugh at me now. Oh, boy.
Aww.
Yep.
Yeah. And his performance techniques are so awkward to me. Like at the end when he's just pleading to everybody, or at the times where he's being very resolute and he pounds on the podium. Oh, boy. So who wants to take on Monson? Brant, lead us on Monson.
Sure,
I need to hear some good things about Monson.
I'll take him on. Well, he first started talking about a poll in the New York Times that was talking about how a majority of young people...
Oh, wait. 230 whole people across the USA. Yeah, 230 whole people.
Only 230?
230 whole people across the USA, right?
Wait, this wasn't a poll. It was a series of interviews, correct?
It was 230 people across the USA, which he said we can safely assume would be the same representative of the whole world.
Because it was in the New York Times, so...
That was the thing that shocked me, though. He cited a poll from the New York Times and not the Deseret News.
230 is a good number. I mean, I'm in the social sciences. I'd love that many people.
For the entire world.
Yeah.
Okay, sure.
So they were talking about moral situations, and he said the thing that these kids couldn't talk about was describing a moral situation, and they talked about their rent and everything like that. And he started extrapolating that to the normal. We are in bad times, and people don't know what's moral and don't know what's not moral. I work with the teenagers in our local ward here, and from what I've been able to tell from them, and my mom's a middle school teacher, and from what I've been able to tell from her, it seems like kids know what's right and what's wrong.
Yeah.
So I wasn't sure what he was getting at there. But he so he talks about that.
I'd be interested in hearing what the actual questions in the survey were. I mean, that would give us some more information on why they might have had trouble responding.
Huh. Yeah, because I think if you were to tell a teenager, okay, tell me about a moral situation that you've been in, I don't know if they'd be able to respond the way that you're wanting them to respond.
Right, unless it's been drilled in their heads in priesthood meetings that this is what immorality is, and if you're ever in a situation like this, you need to make a moral decision, and then they can respond in the appropriate way.
Well, I don't think they would understand moral meaning right and wrong, black and white. I think they would view moral as morality and, okay, have I been sexually pure and have I been chaste and all that stuff.
Oh, I could see that.
But anyway, so we talked about having our faith challenged and needing to have the courage to stand up and stand firm for our beliefs, even when we are mocked and ridiculed for it.
Am I reading too much into this and thinking that this is like a preparation for the upcoming like presidential race and the Book of Mormon musical coming out and all the attention that the church has had?
I don't think you're wrong in that. The reason why is there was a meeting with some prominent church leaders out here in Michigan where the visiting authority basically told the state presidents in attendance that, number one, everyone needs to have a public relations calling. You need to have public relations representatives as a calling within your ward because of the upcoming elections, and you're going to have, you know, two Mormons prominently featured. And someone actually asked him about the Book of Mormon musical, and from what I heard, he said basically, well, he didn't say it was completely bad, but he said it's getting interest on the church. That's what he was saying.
We're having a meeting on October 23rd to talk about the Mormon.org I Am a Mormon ad campaigns. And,
Oh, yeah, we are. Oh.
Yeah. Huh. So I think things are tied into that as well, Chris. I mean, it's just the whole national media tension from the Book of Mormon musical with the presidential election, you know, all those things. I think they're connected, but, mm-hmm. you know, I thought that, you know, he made the statement that ridicule and mockery is a tool of the adversary. And I started writing in my notes, so does righteousness never ridicule wickedness? And I hadn't even finished typing this when he started with this joke about, you know, his own personal experience with the Catholic, Protestant, and Jewish Navy joke, you know, with the petty officer, mm-hmm. where he was essentially mocking and ridiculing these other people who would sleep in on Sunday or be divided up. And but you've got a quizzical look on your face. You don't see that as ridicule or mockery.
Well, but I see it through your eyes, yeah, but I didn't – maybe I just missed it. I didn't pick that up. It was sort of like the Catholics go over here and Protestants go over here and there's Mormons.
And the petty officer who didn't even know who Mormons were.
And he kind of chuckled.
Had no idea. Oh, we all did.
Yeah.
All of us.
Including you.
Well, I was chuckling for different reasons because I was ridiculing them. But I mean, it's a form of ridicule. All of, and mockery. And then later on when he told the joke about what was the one I turned to you?
I didn't think the bus driver.
Yeah, the bus driver and stuff. But we do this all the time when we're like ridiculing other people who don't know aren't.
That's like one way to frame it, I think. I didn't see it that way.
Okay.
I didn't see it that way. I just saw it as a regular story. I think there used to be a lot more mockery, but
it draws lines between us and them, Brant.
Yeah, but it's really it's toned down drastically within the last little bit. You don't have people writing books comparing the Catholic Church to the great and abominable church anymore because you can't do that anymore.
No, and I mean I didn't feel like he was openly ridiculing Catholics
or Protestants or Jews, but he was definitely making these distinctions between others. And there was something in his tone about this petty officer. And maybe it was just his, you know, we mentioned at the beginning that the way he was being overdramatic in his mannerisms, maybe it was just that. But, you know, the way that the people were getting into his story and joke, it just seemed, I don't know. Well, like, come on, ridicule and mockery. It just doesn't seem like it's that far off from, they're really a tool of the devil. Yeah.
No, I mean, it's just another form of criticism. And wasn't the whole opening story about the survey and people not knowing how to make moral decisions? That was a criticism about the world.
Don't go after my ridicule and mockery.
I'm going.
Don't go after my ridicule and mockery.
I'm going for it, buddy.
No, I'm not talking to you.
But, I mean, I just thought it was just, like, that whole opening, the whole opening story about the people that didn't know how to answer moral questions. I mean, I just thought that thing was so ridiculous. And when the conclusion they drew from it was basically like that subjective forms of deciding, like using your feelings. He criticized the idea deciding what is moral based on feelings.
That was interesting to me because it contrasted this morning with President Packer talking about how, you know, it's a feeling. And then President Monson says, based on how you feel, well, that's not a good guide.
Right.
Right. Well, and, you know, to me, it's no different than church members. You know, they've just been pre-programmed to feel a certain way about certain things and feel very strongly about them. And so they see that as morality.
Right.
Okay. He said that he quoted President Benson that this generation is comparable in wickedness to the days of Noah. The difference is us, that we were the strongest children that had been held in reserve to kind of hold up. I haven't heard this kind of millennial speech for a long time.
Yeah, it seemed like they were dying out on it, but here it is again.
Yeah, so last days are upon us, and here we are. What'd you guys think about that?
I just wondered how these statements are going to sound 50 or 100 years from now.
Yeah, but Packer earlier today basically said that you're – he basically assumed the fact that the world's not going to end anytime soon. I don't remember exactly what he said, but it was something like your grandchildren will be around and maybe your great-grandchildren. It sounded like the world's not ending soon.
Yeah, you could have read it a couple ways in saying that you shouldn't expect that, you know, you're not going to be around. You know, even if the second coming were to happen, you'd be able to have grandchildren. Or it could be read that, yes, the second coming is not going to happen until you have grandchildren or great-grandchildren.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've gotten to the point where you're not growing in the country of your origin anymore, like, that's apocalyptic. I mean, I think that that's almost apocalyptic in terms of the church. The church has never had zero net growth in the United States.
Time of the Gentiles being fulfilled. It was prophesied. Yeah. Hey, okay. Yeah. Any final words to wrap us up? Because we got to finish this off.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Monson really just cast anyone who doubts, anyone who listens to the criticism of people who criticize us and doesn't dismiss it instantly, and allow and legitimizes those criticisms and really thinks about them and perhaps doubts about their own religion, like, all of that is bad, right? There's a total line in the sand, and you cannot doubt.
Nope.
And still be a good person.
You can't. Mm-hmm. You can't have. Can't trust God and Mammon. Can't have it both ways.
Yeah. Once you get to the tree of life, you have to stay there, yeah. Even if, you know, you just stay there, because they never mention what happens after you get to the tree, right? You just kind of hang around the tree, I guess.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for joining in, reviewing Priesthood Session of Conference. And as always, the discussion continues on the website. MormonExpression.com. Thanks for joining in. Talk to you later.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.